Blog Talk Radio.
This is Debbie Gangeist with the Pedowitz Group, and welcome to WRMR, Revenue Marketer Radio. Every Thursday at 2 o'clock, we meet to talk to a real revenue marketer. Now, these are not traditional marketers. A revenue marketer is a specific kind of marketer who has revenue or revenue-related accountability. These marketers are responsible for the top of the sales funnel and for interacting with and nurturing leads until they are sales ready. It's a very unique combination of skills, and it's a very elite class of marketer. And today's topic is, I didn't know what I didn't know. I not only love that theme, but I admire the bravery of Emily Salas, who is Director of Marketing at CollabNet, to actually admit that. It's one of my very favorite phrases when I talk about my early days in marketing automation and demand generation. So let me introduce you guys to Emily, and then we're going to find out how come she didn't know what she didn't know. Emily is currently the Director of Marketing at CollabNet, and was one of Marketo's first 50 customers. She has had over 20 years of marketing experience, which means she started when she was about 12 years old, including roles at CNET, Lithium Technologies, and Sleepy Cat Software, which is now Oracle. How many people knew that? And she has spoken and written about topics, including marketing open source software, marketing automation, and lead scoring. She was a major author and contributor to Marketo's Definitive Guide to Lead Scoring, and she's also the author of Mean Marketing Blog at ewsalas.com. Please go check it out. It is pithy, to say the least. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So when you and I were chatting about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, you had a blog topic. What was it about, menopause and marketing automation or something?
Oh, that clearly shows we're women here, but it was getting over the marketing automation middle age.
Oh, yeah, the middle age, absolutely, which is a very funny thing to say when you think about marketing automation because, quite frankly, it really hasn't been around, and it's very much still in its adolescent stage, which is why I'm so delighted to have you on the show today because of your deep experience. But why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about CollabNet and your role there?
Sure thing. CollabNet provides the most widely used platform for distributed software development. Project members all over the world can work as a single team throughout the life cycle of software development, from design to development to building to testing. So that ensures traceability for the executive team and also easy tool use down to the developer level. So it's a really great set of tools and platforms that CollabNet provides. Now, my role here is a little of everything. I'm responsible for our Marketo implementation and installation, so I got that going. And that includes right now scoring, nurturing any additional implementation with other systems, working with our Salesforce administrator, and then also analytics, working with our lead processing, that's our in our Chennai office in India, and additionally, some writing, some strategy, and some sales enablement. So I'm all over the place. I got my fingers in everything.
It sounds like a partridge in a pear tree because that's a pretty long list there. One of the things that people are always interested in when we talk to them, Emily, is they sometimes they get the idea that marketing automation is only for large marketing departments. How large is your marketing department, and how are you guys structured around marketing automation?
Sure thing. Our marketing department is about 6 here in, or maybe 7 here in Brisbane, California. And we've got an additional 4, a manager and 3 lead processing people in our Chennai office. And they are strictly focused on getting leads into the system, database cleaning and database management, that team. Here, we're basically, I work closely with the person who specializes in demand generation. We have someone who's focused on writing, a brand manager, our senior director overseeing everything, and then we've also got a CMO. And we have an open rec for a senior director of product marketing, so we'll get that out there too.
Okay. If anybody's listening or looking for a job, there you go. Okay. So I think this is a really interesting structure. So, again, you know, you guys are a pretty lean marketing organization, but I'm very, very interested in these three lead processing people you have. Can you tell me a little bit more about those roles? And for those of our listeners, Chennai is actually in India. So tell me what these three lead processors do.
Certainly. Our lead processing team, first of all, I want to say they work so hard. And I want to emphasize that. They're a really great team, and two of them are new to the company about a month ago, so we're welcoming them and training them and getting them up to speed. It's been a delight to have them come on board. So what they really focus on is we get so many leads coming into the system, and this is part of the reason why we implemented marketing automation initially. But we have so much coming in, and some people are coming to the website, and they're downloading our open source product, and they're going off and they're using that. And that's subversion, and that's the most widely used software configuration management tool that's out there. So people are mapping their changes and their branches to code and the merging back in of the code, and they're using subversion. So a lot of people are coming to our site and downloading open source products. You might know that software developers tend to be a little bit on the cagey and cautious side, so frequently they're setting up an email address strictly to download software and then abandoning it, and you need to make sure that if that is an abandoned email address, that spam trap is not getting in your database. So we need to do some validation of email addresses and other information. We do that automatically, but that doesn't mean that ultimately that email address is still valid. So also we're making sure that we have the information about the company, the country that person is in, because we have a worldwide organization. And so the lead processing team is doing a huge amount of data cleaning and also just spotting any things they see going wrong or changing or something broken with lead assignment rules, with scoring, anything else like that. So they're kind of my eyes and ears into a database that is almost a million right now.
Oh, I was going to ask you how large your database is. It's around a million contacts?
Yes, it's enormous.
Okay. That is a very large. And, you know, we've had a number of guests on the show, and I always ask our guests at the end, you know, what's the number one piece of advice? And a lot of people will begin by talking about quality of data. And so clearly you, again, with a contact database of a million records, having these lead processors to continuously validate and make sure that the quality is there, especially around the kind of business you have where these IT folks, they are cagey, they are cautious, and they do use multiple, you know, addresses. I think that's just a very, very smart idea. So I wanted to kind of bring that to light because I think this is a really excellent model that you have in place here. So let's go back in time, and let's go back to, you know, what was going on at CollabNet where you guys said, wow, we need a marketing automation system. So tell us about that.
So it's a bit of a historical background, and it's before I joined, but we united our community, which is OCN, Open CollabNet, with our main website. And when that happened, so many people who were downloading open source products, some of whom are potential customers and some of whom aren't, got into the database, and all of a sudden sales went, whoa, what are we going to do with this? Because between 3,500 and 5,000 new names were coming into the database every week.
Okay.
Now, I don't know a sales team that can deal with trying to sift out who to target and who not to if they're getting, as a whole, you know, if a sales team's getting 5,000 leads. I don't know a sales team that could deal with that. And so sales said, give us a way to figure out who to contact first. Give us a way to prioritize. And the company determined that what they really needed was lead scoring so that we could do something like that. And I was brought in basically, they had gone down to three products that they were considering for marketing automation. And I want to emphasize that basically they were considering how do we get lead scoring in place. And that's one of the things I didn't know is we were really focused on lead scoring, and marketing automation is much larger than that. So I really wish I'd had a better picture of what the capabilities of marketing automation were versus this small piece of it that is lead scoring.
You know, Emily, you're exactly right. And again, I think those of us who've been in marketing automation a long time, we forget at some point what we didn't know. And I often see people who completely just don't have a basic understanding of what marketing automation is, especially versus CRM or versus an email service provider. So I think that's a very, very valid comment. And I think all vendors would do a much better job if they would just step back and say, remember, these people don't know what they don't know. You know too much. And so just share with them, you know, without a lot of jargon, just the basic functions and features of marketing automation. So I think that's an excellent call out there. Okay, so you guys are looking at lead scoring, but marketing automation was much bigger than that, but you just weren't aware of that at the time.
Exactly, and it was, okay, we need lead scoring, and oh, by the way, this does, you know, this sends emails too. Well, we're already using something to send our emails with, so now we have the ability to use one system both to do the scoring and to send those emails. But there wasn't a big strategic or large view of how did these things fit together.
And what year was this?
I beg your pardon?
What year did this happen?
This is the summer of 2008.
Okay.
So we needed to approach lead scoring, and I knew nothing. There was this technology, and I was going to go and do the RFP and do the pilot, and really, I'll confess, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who are probably kind of in the same boat, but I was just making it up as I went along. I didn't really know where to start. I didn't really know how do you start a scoring program. How do you transfer those email, you know, what your email program is now, and then further down the road, how do you transform that email program from a batch and blast to a real nurture program that's doing what you need it to do to deliver quality leads to sales? So there was a lot I didn't know. But part of my charter when I started was to make sure that I was working with sales, and that sales was a huge part of the decision and how lead scoring was going to work and how this was all going to fit together, because really the request had come from sales, help us be able to define who to contact first.
Okay, tell us about how you work with sales, because we often see, and I tell marketers this day in and day out, a key factor to success. Hello?
Yes.
Okay, just make sure you guys are down. My heart stopped. I'm like, oh, my gosh, have I been disconnected? But we see day in and day out, I can go into any organization and ask them questions around how the relationship between sales and marketing is working, and I can tell you whether or not they're really getting a revenue impact from marketing. So tell us more about this charter to work with sales, and how did you accomplish that?
Well, I have to say one of the bonuses here was that I was new to the company, and so I didn't know how marketing and sales had been working previously. I only knew that I needed to meet these people in sales, find out what their requirements were, find out what the people in marketing who had been here before me, what their requirements were, and try to mend that and fix that and make that work together. So it was kind of nice to be able to start with a fresh slate and just say, well, I'm new, so you have to educate me about everything. But that could happen also if you're not new to the company. You could say, you know, we're starting a new initiative, and let's start from scratch. Let's, you know, tell me what, you know, in a perfect universe, what does sales want from marketing? What does marketing want to deliver to sales? What does marketing want back from sales? How are we going to do this? Let's talk about what the ideal is, and then let's worry about how to implement it.
So when you began these conversations with sales, and one of the very first things that you did was begin really talking about lead scoring. So tell us about those conversations.
So the first question I had to ask was, well, first I had to understand how lead scoring worked. And basically now I think most people approaching it understand that you want to score both on kind of the profile or the demographics of what that person looks like and whether they're suitable as one of your buyers or not. And then also look at what are they doing? What's their activity? Are they on your website? Are they downloading things? Are they attending your webinars? Are they listening to your radio show? So you really want a combination somehow of activity and profile. But I had to go and ask sales, tell me who your sales target is. Tell me what you think your sales candidate looks like. And I also dug in, we use Salesforce, and I dug into Salesforce and I looked at opportunities that were open but not, you know, hadn't yet closed, and I looked at closed one and I dug into some of those records and looked at who's there, you know, what titles are we selling to and what size company do they have to be at, and is that in a country that we can reach because we have partners all over the world, but let's make sure that that's a company that we can support if they buy from us, because you don't want to sell something that you then have trouble enabling
yep.
and supporting your
yep.
customer.
Yep.
So, you know, what does that person look like? And then I said, and what do you want them to have done? What do you want that person to know by the time you get them? You know,
that's a great question. I have never heard anybody. So what is it that you want them to know before you reach them? That's a great question. I've never heard that question posed before. It's always been kind of like, what kind of activity do you want to see? But what a great question. What is it that you want them to know before you reach out to them? Love that question, Emily.
Thank you. Well, yeah, so not just what have they done, but, you know, where do they have to be? What kind of education do they have to have? Do they have to have a view of there's a problem? I always say that part of marketing's job is to instill a little paranoia. First, you have to educate people that they do have a problem, and then you have to show them how you can fix it.
Yep.
So I was very interested in sales telling me, you know, is it enough if someone just is downloading and doing a trial of our platform product, or do you want them to have also read something about a case study or attended a webinar or done something? How deep a dive do you want them to have done before you feel like you can have a conversation about a sale? So based on that feedback, I then went and looked at the database and did some random selections and created an enormous spreadsheet manually and started with, you know, if this is our ideal and it's going to reach our points threshold, then what are the different pieces that need to go together and how do we need to score these things so that the features and the activities that sales is telling me do add up to that points threshold?
So what were some of the things that you guys, the specifics that you guys scored on, Emily?
Title, the size of the company, so the revenue of the company, activity like attending a demonstration of our software versus attending a webinar that's kind of an overview educational piece, downloading a case study, downloading a white paper, visiting certain pages on the website. I mean, I will say that Marketo's Definitive Guide to Lead Scoring has done a really nice job of just laying out all the different things, you know, lists of things that you could consider scoring on. But then you need to look at that and say, well, what is the relative value of one thing to another? Is title more important than certain activity, or is activity more important than title?
Right. Okay. So did you guys just, like, create this scoring methodology one time and bam-o, it was perfect?
No. It's never perfect. In fact, I definitely ought. It's still changing. I mean, When we first implemented Marketo, there was only one scoring field. Now there's, you know, there are new features all the time, and I want to actually take that and split out the scoring so that we now have separate scoring for profile versus activity. So I'm in the process of doing that, of kind of we combined them before, and now I want to pull them apart so that we can say, well, this person's all over doing all these activities, but they really don't meet our buying profile, or they meet a buying profile for a certain product. So this one is kind of a high velocity product. We're going to automate that sales process as much as we can, versus this one, which is more of an enterprise sale, and that's going to take a lot of different leads in the system. There'll be a lot of people involved in that buying decision, and that's something that's going to go out to our field salespeople to work on.
And I think that's really smart. I found that the two scoring fields is highly effective.
But I want to go back to your initial conversation with salespeople. And when you said, hey, guys, have you guys ever thought about what online activity means? And, you know, for example, have you ever thought about if one person comes to our site and goes to two pages versus 15 pages? Or have you ever thought about what the activity means if they go to a special section of our website? Tell me some more detail around that conversation, because in my experience, salespeople a lot of times have not ever really thought about that. So how did you get them thinking about that, and how did you get them to evaluate certain behaviors?
So I will say that it was a bunch of questions that they hadn't really considered before, and I want to say that the conversation with sales was not, you know, it's not a conversation. It was, you know, two meetings a week for a couple of months as we started to have the conversation and we moved forward, and I did some validation and brought them the research and the data I'd done, and I brought them that spreadsheet and said, these are the results. It was really a give and take, and it really, you know, we started going with scoring, but there was still, it takes time, and the conversation takes time. It's not, we had one meeting, we agreed, and we went off and we implemented it. It's an ongoing process, and so there, you know, I was meeting with our sales management for months, and I still do regularly. I have to work closely with sales operations. I have to work closely with our director of corporate sales, because this is where the rubber hits the road. It's an ongoing conversation.
And I completely agree. And again, I think the lesson learned here is that it's not turn it on and, you know, and it's done. But the other thing that I like that you did, and I want to get to some more detail on this, Emily, is the fact that you had a series of initial conversations and then you went back and validated, right? So tell me, what was the process through which you did validation? How did you validate some of the assumptions that you guys made?
So we sat down in a room, and I said, based on what you've already told me in previous meetings, this title plus this kind of activity plus this kind of web visit would equal our threshold. And I set it at 100 because it's really easy to do percentages of 100 in your head. It's really hard to do percentages of, you know, 641 in your head.
Yeah.
I set it at 100 and said, this is going to be our threshold. But you could really set that anywhere. But what I did is I went and I said, okay, based on these things that you've told me, and like I said, I created this spreadsheet, and I took leads that were in marketing, leads that were unqualified, that was really interesting. I took contacts with opportunities, I took opportunities that were open, I took closed one, and what I looked at was if I were to score these, based on the assumptions that we're making today, would the ones that are current opportunities have been delivered to sales about the time that that opportunity was created or a little bit before? So what I wanted to find out is, if we score it this way, are things going to get to sales about the time they're getting to sales now, for the things that are moving forward? And then I also wanted to kind of reverse that and say, for the things that sales said, these are unqualified, why'd you send them to us? Would they have ever gone to sales in the first place? And what was really strong in validating the data was seeing that the vast majority of those that had been unqualified by sales would never have gone to sales in the first place. So they wouldn't have involved that salesperson's time sales could have focused instead on someone who has a much higher chance of getting further down the funnel, being an opportunity, closing that sale. So I wanted to make sure not only that the good stuff went to sales, but that the stuff that wasn't ready yet didn't go to them.
So when you did that validation, did you turn on the basic lead scoring and just kind of do it under the cover so nothing got delivered, just so you can kind of see how the scores, or was it kind of a manual, let me eyeball some of the key things that we have?
It was manual. It was a 400-line spreadsheet.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
because once I started doing the data, sales said, this is great. We love this. Could you test it on, you know, another 15 on this particular area so that we can check that this particular part of the funnel is going to work correctly? Could you check it on this? Could you add a couple more in here? And so it started at about 200 rows, and over time it grew to about 400 rows. And I didn't know any other way to do it, so I did it in an Excel spreadsheet.
I love this idea. Again, you know, just the fact that you took the input and you went back and did some validation and testing, and you could have done it easier by doing most things that worked out, but that's okay. We didn't know what we didn't know at the time. But the
one of the reasons I didn't do that is because you only get one chance to make a first impression.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to turn it on, have the salespeople go, this isn't working, and write off lead scoring from the start. I wanted to check first.
Yeah. But I love the fact that you got them sucked in and participating in the activity, because all of a sudden they were seeing value that they would receive from this, and they were saying, hey, Emily, can we test this? Hey, Emily, can we test this? What a great
way to get them involved.
Yeah.
And one of the things we've done is it wasn't, as you say, set it and forget it. We've changed the scoring on a few things. And then after running it for 3 or 6 months, I'll go back and say, did this get us what we were looking for? Did increasing the score here or lowering the score here increase the number? So I'm not interested so much in what goes to sales. I'm interested in what goes to sales and sticks.
Right.
I want to know that sales says, wow, that's good, and I'm going to keep that, versus, nah, it's not quite ready yet, go nurture it some more, or why did you send this to me in the first place?
So, Emily, do you have a lead, I don't know if you call them a marketing qualified lead, but when that lead passes from marketing over to sales, do you track that conversion rate?
Yes.
And has that conversion rate been improving as your lead scoring has improved?
It has been. Now, I will say, and this is going to get down, it's continuous improvement. You can't ever stop. It's never, until you get 100%, you're not done. And then when you get 100%, you're going to have to learn to replicate it for another product. So, you're never done, and that's kind of part of the fun part. But it's really important not just to see what's going on, but to keep improving it. But before lead scoring, I will say this is one of the benefits, is we didn't really know what our conversion rates were. We didn't have a way of measuring that until we had lead scoring in place. So lead scoring has given us the ability to kind of find out where everything is in the funnel, see where it's moving forward, see where it's getting stuck, and to give us those initial metrics
that
we didn't have before.
That's absolutely excellent. And so you turned on lead scoring for the first time when?
About September 2008.
Okay.
It was a very fast process.
It sounds like it. And then how many major tweaks have you made to it since September 2008?
I couldn't tell you. We've changed things. We've changed things back. We do small tests all the time. And so I don't think that it gets – there's not a real wholesale change. It's, let's look here. Let's drill down on titles, or let's drill down on these particular activities, or we're seeing this happen with people who do this particular activity. So let's examine that more closely and see if we can refine it. I think really going into changing from a composite score to two separate scores is going to be a huge overhaul for the first time, but we've certainly made other changes along the way.
So let me ask you this question. So clearly, you know, one of the major, I mean, one of the reasons for this chasm between marketing and sales is, you know, marketing giving them 5,000 leads a week, and who the heck knows how good anything is. Since you guys have started lead scoring, how has sales' attitude toward leads that they get from marketing changed?
I think it's improved. It's still not 100%. That relationship is always, you know, we're always trying to change and improve and do things. But the most rewarding thing was when one of the sales directors in EMEA came to me and he said, before we implemented this, when I was traveling on the road and I was in a hotel and I had a slow connection on my computer, I couldn't even send an email to my team because I was getting so many notification emails that there was a new lead in my Salesforce queue. Now, I get about 20 of those. I can look at them. I can send them personal emails, and I'm getting about 75% of those writing back to me and asking for more information. So he went from, I can't even look at my email or send a message to my team, to I can engage with three-quarters of the people who you have sent to me, and I can move that sale, I can move that potential sales forward.
And they must love that real-time aspect of getting these leads.
Absolutely. You know, this is fast, and it does mean that if you make a mistake, and you know, you do make scoring mistakes, if you make a mistake, it happens right away. The good news is, if you need to correct it, you can make that happen right away, too.
You can correct that right away as well. You're absolutely right. It's real time in the world of marketing automation, and certainly Marketo integrated with Salesforce.com just does an absolute fabulous job of that. So you've told us that what's next for you in lead scoring is going from composite to kind of separating out the score between their demographic data and their online behavior. And when will you have that done, Emily?
I'm not sure because I'm working on the revenue cycle modeler and the revenue cycle explorer. And so I'm kind of caught up in finding out the data on the funnel, and then I need to go back and work on the scoring. So I don't know when that deliverable is going to happen because I'm focused on another burning issue, which is the revenue cycle analytics and Explorer, which I think has huge potential for the company as well.
Yeah, so I do want to talk about that. And again, this is not a show that is focused on feature and functions of different marketing automation systems, but this is a fairly new offering from Marketo, which in my opinion is extraordinarily hot. So why don't you share with our audience, Emily, what the revenue cycle modeler and Explorer is and what you think it's going to do for you and why it's important to the revenue marketer.
Sure thing. Well, about 18 months ago, maybe a little more, we actually met with Marketo, and they said, you know, we're working on our reporting, you're working on your reporting, let's share that information, what do you need to know, because we need to build out our analytics. So I'm really pleased. I feel like that's, in some ways, that's my product, because I told them what my specs are, and I'm seeing a lot of those starting to be built out in the product. So, you know, I asked for this, and here it is. So that's pretty exciting to me just as a customer. But what it really is, what we really need to know as marketers is where is everything? So like your bank balance, where, you know, how much is in there, how much came in, how much went out, and how fast is that happening, and what percentage of that is going any which way. And so as an overview, what I want to know is there are 10 in this bucket, 12 came in, 22 went out, and that happened within 2 days, and, you know, this percentage of them went to the next stage, and this percentage of them fell out. So that's what I'm interested in, like how fast are things moving through my funnel? Are they getting stuck? Are they getting backed up anywhere? What's going on? So what the modeler does is allows you to kind of do a picture of where all your different stages are on your path to success, on your path to a close one, for all the way from an anonymous lead all the way through however you name them to sales ready to opportunity to close, and then to also be able to diagram what's coming out of your funnel or any leapfrog. So if it could go from stage one to stage three and skip over stage two, you need to know that too, and you need to know how many are bypassing that, as well as how many are being resubmitted to sale or resubmitted to marketing to be recycled and nurtured a little further, and how many are unqualified and what's going on. So it allows you to map that out, and once you've assigned the leads in your database to that to the different stages in that diagram, it's going to tell you what those conversion rates are and what those balances are and how many in, how many out, and what's going on. So I'm only at the beginning. I've only just turned it on. We have so many leads that, you know, if you have a bucket that's got 400,000 names in it and 20,000 of them move, it barely shows up. So I'm clearly going to need to narrow down my division so we can see the movement.
I love this idea.
But then the Explorer enables you to basically query that data and do different pivot tables and ask questions about the data that you're seeing there.
So this really, for the first time, gives the marketer a way to proactively manage the lead funnel from very beginning to very end, not just to get a snapshot in time. So, for example, if I take a snapshot today versus I want to be able to know how my whole lead funnel is working from beginning to end, and, of course, it pulls information from Salesforce, so you don't have to be beholden to the Salesforce.com administrator to get the conversions and the metrics that you need. That sounds pretty hot, Emily.
I think it's going to be. I think it's got huge potential because you can go into Salesforce and you can pull out a million reports and extract those. But if you can show that to your senior executives or to your board in a pictorial way that helps them understand what's going on and what you project will happen in the future with those leads, That's gonna help you a lot, both sales and marketing. You know, this is what we can expect to close in two quarters is better information than this is what we closed last quarter.
Well, it also gives you the picture of the entire life cycle of the lead, not just when it enters into Salesforce, right? So all the work that marketing's doing at the top, you know, to nurture and get themselves ready, and then as it moves, as you can see all those stages as they move through. And you're right, being able to show that in a pictorial way. So it also helps you run your business because, as you were saying, you need to see the very top of the lead funnel, even before it gets into the sales funnel. You know, how are things moving? Are things moving? Are things getting stuck? And a picture paints 1,000 words, and the fact that you can go in and query the database and find out all that information, you know, I agree with you. I think this has a huge potential. I think for the first time, it's really giving marketing a way to even more concretely show the impact of all of the activities that they're doing to kind of get leads sales ready and then actually how it goes through the entire cycle. That's very exciting.
Yeah, I think so. And so I'm, like I say, you know, you need to let it run for a while before you see everything moving because what a Salesforce report gives you is a snapshot. What you want to see is that moving picture. You want to move from a photograph to a movie.
Absolutely.
And see where things are going. And then once you see where that movie is going, maybe you can, you know, predict kind of what the next scene is going to be.
Well, not only that, but this the next time, you know, quotas are set or the company says we have to hit this much revenue, you can back it up all the way to know from top to bottom how many leads need to be in each stage. You've got a predictable conversion rate from the very first time someone becomes known all the way through opportunity and then all the way through close, so that marketing can really be that core foundation that loads the top of the funnel with sales-ready leads so that sales can go close them.
That's exactly it. And then also, you know, where are the conversion rates lower than you think they should be, and what do you do to change that?
Absolutely. So when are you going to show this to your executives? When's the first time you're going to give them a picture of what's going on, Emily?
I don't know. I'm scared. What I'm noticing is because our database is so large, I'm not sure that we get a picture because, again, 2,000 or 20,000 is such a small fraction of something like 400,000 that really that conversion percent is going to show is zero. because you're getting such a small percent, even though there's a great mass moving. So I think that what it's showing me first is that we need to make those buckets a little smaller so that we're able to see that movement and it doesn't fall off the charts.
You're absolutely right. You're going to have more buckets. But, again, you know, small, tiny improvements in conversion when you're working with a million contact database can have very large revenue potential implications, right? It's not like a company that has, you know, I've got 10,000 total contacts and, you know, it's just going to be, you know, very, very, very different. So I got to tell you, that's just a completely outstanding overview of what you've been doing around lead scoring. And thank you so much for sharing some of that detail with us. And also thank you for sharing with us around what you're doing around as a marketer to kind of get a handle for what your pipeline and what your revenue cycle, you know, is actually like. I think that's very exciting, and I can't wait to hear more about your adventures with the revenue cycle modeler and explorer, so that because I do think that's a huge thing for marketers to have their own pipeline, just like sales has their own pipeline that they can manage and get all this information from. Marketers need, you know, that exact same thing. But one of the other things that I wanted to have you share with us also was I know that you guys have done some pretty innovative things with nurturing campaigns. And clearly, at the very beginning, you guys were looking for something that could do lead scoring, and that's kind of when you didn't know what you didn't know. And certainly, you've come a far, far way since then. And clearly, moving from batch and blast to taking more of a nurturing approach was one of those transitions that you went through. So why don't you tell us a little bit around what you do in the nurturing area?
Well, I'll tell you first that I think that's still I don't know what I don't know. I think there's so much more that you can do with nurturing, and I'm pretty sure that there's no company using Marketo, including Marketo, that has exhausted the possibilities of what can be done. And I know that other Marketo customers have some pretty complex nurture things going on out there, and it's amazing to be able to learn from your peers just and get ideas and just see what other people are doing. So the community, the Marketo User Summit, all of that gives me insight and ideas of, oh my goodness, I could be doing that too. So one of the things that was one of the first things we implemented was once someone downloaded either our open source product Subversion or downloaded our platform, they kind of just fell in with everyone else into our database. And we needed a way to kind of follow up and acknowledge that they had downloaded and figure out, you know, even if you're downloading open source, does that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not a potential customer for other things. So what I did is the first things I set up were some nurture programs following up on downloads. So, you know, you've just downloaded this. Here's how you can get the most out of your download or your trial or you know, here's how you can check out this product and see if it meets your needs. And so I did some, and I experimented a lot. We said, well, maybe one every 2 weeks, and then it was one a day, and then it was one every 2 days, and we settled out at about once a week. And so there was some testing on what the frequency should be and also how many there should be. But I also did some fancy footwork in Marketo and basically said, I want to give people a way to opt out of this particular thread if they're an experienced user, to opt out of this nurture thread without opting out of email as a whole. So I did I called up Marketo support and I said, this is what I want to do. Got any ideas? And they were very helpful. And eventually I ended up building in some ways for people to say, okay, I know what I'm doing here with this download, I don't need your help, versus, okay, just stop sending me emails altogether. But I really wanted to give our downloaders ways of getting started and resources that they could use in evaluating our product and finding out, what the next thing to do was to see if that product suited their needs.
So tell us, what was the impact of you putting that particular nurture campaign in place?
Well, I have to say it's one of the campaigns with the highest open and click rates because you're giving people tools. And one of the advantages there for marketing, I think, is that you're presenting the company as here we're an advisor rather than trying to sell you something. You've decided to download this. You've decided to try out our software. We're going to help you understand how that could help you, but we're not going to say, and then buy it now. You know, we're going to give you that option, but we're not going to, you know, we're going to be your advisor here. We're going to help you get the most that you can out of testing this product. And we're also going to give you some guidelines of how you might want to evaluate. You know, what are the rules of evaluation? And one of the things that does for the company is it frames the conversation. So if a potential customer is evaluating our platform and someone else's, by providing them with a way of evaluating the product that plays to our strengths, they might then take that those evaluation criteria, go to the competitor and go, but they can't do what this product can do, so I'm going to stay with that. So it's also trying to push the needle in sales.
So when you put this nurturing campaign in place and you did a lot of experimenting, you went from and you kind of settled on once a week, how many sends do you have in that particular nurture program, for example?
It used to be 4, then it was 5. I think at one point it was 6. I think we're back to 5 now.
Okay, so back to 5. And at what point, I mean, what happens to the scoring here while someone's going through this? What, I mean, because you know they're going to be getting a higher score if they do the click-throughs on the emails, right?
Right.
So when you're sending this advisory, let us help you, at what point do they reach a threshold where this gets over to sales? So tell us about that, because that's a question somebody always asks me. We're an advisor. We're trying to help them understand how to use their trial. At what point do we say, oops, and now we're going to sell you, and it goes over to sales?
Right. So that depends both on what they're clicking on. So different assets that we offer them in the emails have different point values. Some of them are more educational assets, and so they're going to be scored lower. Some of them are more kind of, I'm definitely considering a product, so I'm going to move to the next set of assets that's at a higher level or a decision-making level. So the points are based on the type of asset, and then as those points increase, we're also going as towards the end of that nurture, we're going to say, and by the way, if you like using this, here's the platform product, and then you can do what you're already doing plus all this other stuff. So we're also trying to do the upsell through there and introduce them to the trial of the platform product, which is the mainstay of our, and now we've last year acquired two companies. And so we have a lot more products. So we need to update that nurture drip and start saying, you know, and you can get training and you can do hosted services and have your subversion in the cloud. And so there needs to be some updates there already. So, again, it's not set it and forget it.
Right. One of the things that I like that you did, and I think this is a really key point, is that when you're sending out emails, whether it's part of a nurturing campaign or whatever that is, understanding that some of the things that you're offering are educational, and that's going to appeal to people when they're a certain stage of their buying process. Also offering product-specific things so that you can, and if they click on that, you can surmise that they are further along in their buying process. So doing that forethought and not just kind of slinging a whole bunch of stuff out there, and again evaluating if they click on an educational asset, maybe they get 2 points, or they click on a product specific asset, depending on what that is, and they're going to get a whole lot more points because they're going to be further down in their buying cycle. I think that's a really, really smart way to address that. And then, again, it kind of becomes a little bit like Amazon, right? Well, if you like this, then, you might enjoy this as well.
Exactly.
Given that you have a million contacts, how many people do you think you have in this particular nurturing campaign at any one time?
Well, on the open source product, one of the things I've done is unless we have a major release, I make sure that they only get that nurture program once. if you download version 161, I don't want you to get the same nurture program as you do 162, 164, 168.
Right.
You know,
right.
You already got that. So, and there are a lot of people who come back and they are, the people who come back, you know, they're just getting the new version. So we want to make sure we don't do that twice. They'll be in a different nurture program altogether once they've been through the download nurture program. But I think if we're adding about 3,500 a week, the majority of those are from downloads. And so probably we're adding about, I would probably say about 1,000 or 1,500 maybe to that nurture every week or two.
Okay. And do you have any conversion rates of when people go through that nurture campaign? What percent of those actually convert into opportunities?
It depends what product they're downloading. And now that we have new offerings, I'm sure those are going to change. But the vast majority of people who are downloading Subversion really just want to get Subversion. So we don't have high expectations for sales conversion from that. We have much higher sales expectations for conversions from other things. So
okay.
I don't have the numbers on me, but it's also part of Subversion is just that we founded that project. It's an open source project. It's managed by a community. It's now hosted by the Apache Foundation. And, you know, it's not really ours. It belongs more to the community. So we have lower expectations on conversions, but now that we've got some products around that, I think that'll go higher in the future.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, we have just a few minutes left, about 7 or 8 minutes, and so I always like to end the show with a question. I mean, Emily, you've been doing this since 2008, which is a lifetime ago in the industry that we're in right now. You know, what kind of advice, what are the top three pieces of advice you might give to the new marketer who this has been put on their plate? What do you think they should do? What are your top three lessons learned for them? And these people are probably all in the same category you were, and I didn't know. I don't know what I don't know.
Well, I'll say that this much further on, there, first of all, a lot of best practices out there, both there's from Pedowitz Group, from Marketo, from different sources. There are a lot of best practices out there, and I would say go find out what other people are doing first so that you can use, the wisdom of their past experience, which is exactly what you've been asking me about. I'd also say that rather than say you may start with lead scoring or you may start with nurturing, but I think first if you're implementing marketing automation, you need to ask the bigger questions first and then figure out the tactics. So the real question is, what do you want to happen to your funnel and to your sales and marketing organization? And I want to emphasize that sales and marketing as a single organization rather than as two separate ones. So ask the big questions first. What do you want to accomplish as that team? And then figure out what are the tactics and where you want to start. So if I'd known there was a bigger picture to look at earlier on, I think it would have been, okay, we're going to start with lead scoring, but this is really part of a bigger picture and a bigger implementation and a bigger effort and a bigger way of aligning sales and marketing. And then three, I would definitely say don't be afraid to make mistakes. This is marketing. This is not brain surgery. If you make a mistake, if you got a bunch of spam traps in your database, you could be blacklisted. But more likely, if you make a mistake, you've got a misplaced comma. You know, you're not going to kill anyone. So,
exactly.
You know, there are very, as I've told you before, there are very few marketing-related deaths.
Exactly, and I tell people that all the time, especially when it comes to turning on lead scoring. I used to say, you know, no children or animals are harmed, and then Emily shared with me there's no marketing deaths that will occur, absolutely. So, I mean, I think those are good pieces of advice is that, you know, even from 2008 to now, There are so many more best practices out there. I mean, you know, just this radio show alone, I think we've done close to 50 interviews with marketers like Emily, and just hearing what they have done, hearing from peers, and finding out what people are doing and how they're approaching it. I think your idea around asking, okay, sales and marketing organization, what do we really want to have happen? And then coming up with the strategy and the tactics around that. And then I think you're right. The last thing is you really, you know, just don't be afraid to make mistakes. And a good friend of mine, Jim Kaner, he used the expression, and I actually wrote a blog on it some years ago, it's called fail fast and fail forward, right?
Awesome.
And no one, yeah, I love that phrase, and no one's really going to be harmed. So anyway, Emily, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your thoughts and your ideas and your advice with us. We truly enjoyed chatting with you today. I will let our listeners know that we will not have a show on next Thursday. We're actually going to be doing a live show from Online Marketing Summit in San Diego on Monday, February the 7th. I'm teaching a half-day workshop on demand generation, and that's going to be our audience for that week. And so we'll send out some updates so you can all tune in and listen. So thanks to everyone for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed the interview. And everyone have a great week. Thanks a lot, Emily.
Thank you so much, Debbie.